Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you. We are going to be talking this evening about decolonizing mission, which I know is what you've all been hoping we would do. as we've been spending time with the World Mission Initiative Conference on Jesus Christ and the Dividing Wall, which is looking at how the mission of the church has actually been separated from the world around us, even as we've been obviously very active and involved with the world, but we've been separated across this line of racism. We talked about what it means to move sort of outside of all our space and the transformation that happens when we move into somebody else's space. And then we last week had the conversation about, okay, where do we go as a 90-something% white church in a country that is not 90-something% white? How do we engage in mission that is actually sort of stepping us out of this pattern where we are the ones in charge, and move us out into real relationship with our neighbors? This is a World Mission Conference that we've been sort of eavesdropping on, and so we're going to have a conversation this evening between Hunter Farrell, who is the director of the World Mission Initiative at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, one of your fine Presbyterian seminaries, and Tony Igwe, who is an MDiv student, a Master of Divinity student at Pittsburgh Seminary and minister at the Bible Center Church in Homewood, which is in Pittsburgh. So we're going to skip over the part where they introduce themselves, so I'll introduce them very quickly. Tony is from Nigeria. And in Nigeria, he is part of the Igbo people. And he told the story of when he converted to Catholicism, he had to get rid of all of these really, really powerful cultural resources that being Igbo meant. So he had to change his name. His birth name was not Tony. He had to get rid of certain ways of not just doing rituals, but resources in terms of how he connected with the community around him. He talks about that as one of the unintended consequences of the way that mission work and colonialism kind of walked hand in hand as they got certainly to sub-Saharan Africa. I should be specific. Christianity has been in North Africa forever. And has been in sub-Saharan Africa off and on throughout that same time. But when European colonization and the missionaries that came with it arrived in Africa in the 15th century, that was when we really found the way that mission just destroyed the local cultures, because it was wrapped up with these colonial powers. So that's Tony's background. And he is still a Christian. He is a Master of Divinity student. So continuing his education and formation. Hunter is the director of the World Mission Initiative. He grew up in a church that was really deeply committed to local and global mission. 50% of their budget went to local and global mission. Um, uh, he told this really great story from his first mission assignment in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is also in Africa. And the way that he really struggled with, he knew that the thing that the village really needed was water. And the village elders had a different way of getting to that goal than he was comfortable with or happy with, until he realized what they were doing. And that kind of, you know, that kind of opened his mind about how do we need to be in partnership? And he said, you know, because I knew the best way to develop these people, I inflicted collateral damage on them because I wouldn't just get out of the way. And not completely out of the way, right? But I wouldn't move into partnership with them. Instead, it needed to be my way of doing things. And so he has learned. They gave a little bit of history on how we got to this point. How we got to this point was colonizing ships. The way that even just in a single century between 1800 and 1914, in 1800, Europe controlled about 35% of the world's landmass. So the continent of Europe, a few colonial ventures here and there, you know, Canada, Australia, they're big. Over that 114 years, European control of the world rose from 35% of the world's landmass to 84% of the world's landmass. Much of that growth owing to European colonization in Africa. And then they talked about what are some of the positive and negative consequences of this from a mission standpoint, because it was missionaries riding along on these colonizing boats who, you know, they were along for the ride, but they weren't critical enough about the project that the colonial powers were about in Africa, also in Asia, South America. So they said, you know, positive consequences, the gospel was shared. You know, education and medicine and reduction in diseases and, you know, the status of women was elevated and human rights were spread. This is all good stuff. It also, of course, entailed enslavement and cultural erasure and white supremacy spreading into these cultures. So there's this disconnect that has also been part of that colonial experience. On the one hand, they're talking very specifically about international overseas mission. You'll hear relevance to our own international mission partnership in San Ysidro, but you will probably also hear things that are relevant to our own relationships with our neighbors. Our immediate neighbors right in West Des Moines and Des Moines and Urbandale and Johnston, and did I get everybody? I think I got everybody. So you'll hear that in terms of your own actual relationships with real life physical people, even if you have not been to San Ysidro. I've got two short clips from their conversation. They're gonna talk about this colonial logic that says Europeans know best and we should be in control for everybody's good. So that's the colonial logic. And they're going to talk a little bit about that and ask us to notice where that colonial logic happens in our own mission work. Then in the second little clip, they're going to show us, they're going to talk to us about some strategies to decolonize our church's mission practices. So here's the colonial logic, and then here is what it looks like to move out of that model into a new model. So here come Hunter and Tony. So we talk about this colonial logic that is part of our mission work. And again, I want to invite you to think not only of your, you know, of Covenant's mission work as a congregation, but your own engagement with the world around you. And so the logic being that we, the Europeans, know best. And so we should make all the decisions and we should control the processes of getting our resources to you. So we have all the wisdom, we have all the stuff, we have all the means, and kind of your role as sort of the objects of our mission is to just receive that gratefully, ideally. Then we had this these strategies for breaking those patterns of giver and receiver, of going deeper in relationship by actually sharing our faith stories and our struggles and our hopes, and working together on a shared area of concern. So I want to ask, first I want to ask if there are any sort of pieces of what Hunter and Tony said that you feel like you didn't follow and need just clarification on. Okay. If anything comes up that you think, oh, wait, I didn't understand that, go ahead and shout it out.
I think it hit me between the eyes.
That was kind of my feeling of it as well. And particularly in thinking about my own self and the people around me, that sort of model of I should, you know, not that I should always be in charge because that's a lot of work, but that I certainly know best. And that's not actually necessarily the case in my experience. And I think Hunter and Tony would agree with me.
Would you think that's a male view, a strong male view, which is also a colonization kind of logic?
Thank you for saying that out loud so I didn't have to. Yes, so that is totally a gendered assumption that I should know everything and have all the right answers, and that if I ever don't have a right answer, that it's somehow a moral failing on my part. And yes, that is absolutely a piece of this whole colonial logic, right? That there's somebody in the center of the world who has everything and should decide what happens everywhere else. And conveniently, while I'm deciding, I, the white European descended man, while I am in the center deciding everything for everyone else, I also get shares of everything everybody else has. Right? Because this colonial project was also this really extractive project. You know, every time we turn around when we're talking about our neighbors in San Ysidro, we talk about how the land is just completely infertile. And that's because it has been just extracted from, because that is how the colonial project works. That's what the colonial project is for in economic terms. So, yes, absolutely.
You had mentioned you had mentioned some time ago that the fact that when we're dealing with the San Ysidro, we don't just give them things. We wait for them to ask for what they want, which, you know, when I first heard about that, it sounded like a novel idea. But since then, I've thought a lot about it, and these talks we just heard go along with that so thoroughly that, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
The teams that go down, you mean, Russ? The teams that go down and sit with the people, and they're discussing, talking about what it is that they need, and then they bring it back to us? Is that where you're?
Yeah, something like that. When the things that that we give them, in large part, come from the church as a whole, like the fertilizer, the scholarships, and yeah, instead of either the teams to go down or those of us back home deciding we know what they need. The rule is that we may make suggestions, but we wait for them to ask for it.
Got it. Thank you.
And what is the what's the practical reason that we wait for them to ask for it?
Well, if we may decide that they need something, and go to the trouble of getting it for them and expect some gratitude, and that may not be what they need, let alone what they want, for reasons we're not aware of.
Right. They know their situation on the ground better than we do, and better than we ever could, because we don't live there. And so, yeah, we may have an idea that, well, this will solve the problem, and they know exactly why it won't solve the problem. The phrase that has stuck with me, I heard it from Mark Hilliard. I don't know if it was originally his phrase, but he said, that place is an NGO graveyard. These charitable organizations that swoop in to say, here, we've got this solution for you. And they've got water filters in their front yards that they use as benches because they don't filter water anymore because that wasn't the right solution for their problem. And it's not like water is not a problem, but you got to know, you have to know what the situation is to know whether the solution is actually a solution. And Russ, you actually touched on the, so I was careful to say, what's the practical reason that we wait to be asked? But you touched on a little bit the spiritual reason that we have to wait to be asked as well. Because you said the expectation is that the expectation otherwise would be that we're going to make this decision and you know, create this program or deliver these supplies or whatever it is, and expect them to be grateful. And expect them to be grateful. So there's a spiritual piece of this, an actual like Christian practice piece of this. So I wonder if you can identify any of this colonial logic at work, not in your relationship with people way down there. I even waved south. Aren't you proud of me? Not just with those people down there, but where do you see that colonial logic at work in your day-to-day relationships with other people?
The word self-determination comes up from time to time, and that is supposedly unquestioned, that we allow peoples the right of self-determination. With that, I guess, goes the idea that they might or might not be wrong, but at least there's a dignity in having self-determination. But what are the times when we do know what's best? Now, for example, with Tony, he would not even be Christian if some pushy white folks hadn't come in and colonized the DRC. That's too iffy for me to follow that very far. But I think that just saying, let's go sit in their front yards and wait until they ask for something, I don't think that's it either.
I don't think that's what Tony is suggesting either. No. And in in a piece of the video that we did skip over just in the interest of having time for our discussion, he did specifically talk about the, you know, looking at the European colonial project in Africa and the way that the missionaries rode along on the colonizing ships. Literally, they got on the same ship with the, you know, the soldiers and the colonial governors and the everybody who was going there to extract resources from Africa. And he said there were genuine positive consequences of this, not least of which, in his estimation, is the planting of churches and the translation of the Bible. But he also talked about the spread of education and the things that Western medicine did for the people of Africa over that 114 years and longer, the reduction in disease in those places, the elevating the status of women, the principle of human rights. So he acknowledges that all of those things were good things, and along with that came enslavement and the erasing of African cultures and the spread of white supremacy into these cultures. And so he's not saying you should just walk away. But where is that? I mean, we're going to get to how would we talk about being in mission, even if, you know, even thinking about mission specifically in terms of the spreading of the gospel. We could talk about how would we go about spreading the gospel in ways that actually break us out of this colonial logic. So we could have that conversation. I think Tony would be happy to have that conversation based on what I've seen from him in this in the conversation he had tonight. Where is that colonial logic already alive and at work in our own lives?
I haven't heard much of that kind of talk since I would go to school with my parent or to church with my parents, which would be early 50s. If you're saying there isn't so much of that logic around anymore, I might agree, but I don't think you're asking. And I don't think that there is. I get reluctant about fighting the last war.
So by which you mean this conversation about the colonial logic of European colonization in Africa, you're saying that that's not relevant to a present day West Des Moines conversation?
I think as history, yes. In terms of deciding what we should do, I'm concerned that we would just be stuck in that history, because I don't get the feeling that's what's going on anymore. Maybe, obviously, I'm not in the position that they are, and perhaps you are, and perhaps some of the rest of all of y'all are. But I haven't heard that kind of talk, you know, let's go to some other country and save the brown people. I haven't heard that for a long time. So if we come up with some ways we can avoid that, that's fine. But I don't think we need to fixate on what's been going on, because maybe I'm wrong. I don't think that's what is going on.
I think a lot of times churches that have resources available to them go to a faraway place globally, perhaps, or down south, the Appalachian Mountains, where there are more rural or more communities that are and have a lot more poverty than we do in Clive and West Des Moines and Urbandale. And they do whatever it was they were going to do, and then they leave and come back and never think about it again. And they did their good thing for this year, They, when I talk to certain people about mission work that their church does, they know very little about it, but they wrote a check or they gave money, or they haven't taken the time to be on a delegation. And I don't mean that negatively. I have not been to San Ysidro, and I put a lot of hours into it to keep the mission going because I think it's a worthwhile mission. But we also did family letters hoping to build relationships. And when I have a family that calls me because they haven't heard from their family, and I go into the pastoral team trying to find out where they are or what happened, we get answers back without the coworker. That's been harder. But when someone, Marilyn and I talked about this morning, when someone passes away, Kathy Bassett lets me know, I get a hold of the family that's partnered with that individual, and there's grieving on both sides of the world. So we've done more to build relationships with El Salvador. And I think sometimes we don't know what other churches are doing, but it still happens.
And maybe
where they go to fix it and they fix it and they leave having no idea what the after effects of their fix were.
Right. Or it's a superficial fix.
Yeah.
Something that, oh, we painted their church, or we, you know,
yeah,
the desks or whatever may have happened. And I, John, to your point, I have a thought. I hear what you're saying, but in my experience across the places I have lived, I hear the preaching. I hear the European logic, or the colonization logic. I see it happening, and maybe it's just my life experiences. What I see at Covenant, exactly to Deb's point, is that tying people to get, tying is the wrong word. Just having someone down there in San Ysidro that we can kind of communicate with. I know it's rather superficial and it's just, I don't know what you want to call it, like pen pals, but not quite, because we don't do it often enough. And Deb, that's not your problem. I think that should also be up to us, but they probably don't have mail coming in. You'd have to contact. I think St. Boniface is with this group as well. Is that correct? Do we know, Nathan?
St. Boniface's history is a little complicated with this.
Oh, no, right.
With this,
I just know at one point, I think they were building a church or doing something down there, and I don't know what else has gone on. But it is just, I can see exactly what the gentleman we're talking about, when Hunter was speaking. Like I said, it hit me between the eyes. I don't know if it hit anyone else. You have been together for a long time and you know much more about it than I do. But I do feel it's such an eye-opener to have this. I mean, I've been ingrained a long time in Catholicism. And the first thing I'm thinking of, all those man's rules that govern that faith, all of the things that, all of the superficial things that they have, it's just so European and so I absolutely understand what Tony and Hunter are talking about. I mean, I get it. And shame on that. That it hit me so hard. Did it hit anybody else? Was anyone else?
And you know what hit me was the fact that the pictures that they showed are exactly the pictures we see. The white person is framed in the middle of every darn picture. And I started wanting, I just turned in some pictures to Carrie to print tomorrow. And I don't think they're like that, but I do want to go and look after we get off of this lesson class. I'm like, oh no, did I send the wrong pictures? We do that though.
Yeah. And I liked the round table idea, but wouldn't you know, that was a drawing. God forbid we do people sitting together and chatting, which I have seen people in San Ysidro though. I've seen those images of sitting around and music and stuff. Sorry, Nathan, go ahead.
Go ahead, Jean.
I was just gonna say, one of the things that strikes me, especially since we've all been dealing with COVID and our isolation, is that so many of the missions, especially through the church, have always been so distant. I'm sorry. I mean, I do have a family. Jerry and I have a family in San Ysidro, but you don't. It's not like they're next door. It would be so lovely if there would be an opportunity to have an actual, not necessarily a family, but an organization and maybe a family or several families that you work with right here in West Des Moines. I just find, especially now, just trying to stay in contact with people. And I just feel, you know, yes, San Ysidro, and here's my money. And I'm sorry, I do not care to go to San Ysidro as a person that, like the rest of you that are so wonderful about going. But I would be happy to be interacting with a family in West Des Moines and find out if maybe a long time ago, I know Mary and I went down to Phoenix School. We would go once a week. At least, wasn't it, Mary?
Yeah, once a week.
And we read with the first graders, right. and there were little kids that I think they were multilingual. I don't know that they understood English, and we took some of our own books in and read to them, and they looked forward to seeing us. But we don't seem to have that kind of relationship in our church anymore. Granted, it's very difficult right now because of COVID, but I would like to see something like that coming. And I can't remember who it was that could have been Marilyn, because she was always good at that, coming up with getting that organized.
So that was back when Marty Remsburg was a member of Covenant, and Marty was the volunteer coordinator for the West Des Moines schools. But she worked primarily at Phoenix Elementary and Rex Mathis.
Okay.
And she was the one that got you guys started. I happened to be teaching there. I didn't know any of you, but I knew when those volunteers came to read to the kids, because we heard about it when they were out at recess, or I saw them at lunch, they would tell me about the ladies that came to read books. And we did that with our own Head Start program for years and years too.
Well, and it was just standard first graders. That Mary and I each had a group. And my whole point is,
you want more of that.
I need more of a relationship of a group that you can say, okay, you're not going to be so specific and say, what is you want from me? But maybe when you're working with somebody, you can notice that there's something that they need. And that if you can be a tutor, if you can be, you know, if you can teach somebody how to do something. I mean, both Mary and I have sewn for years, and we cook, and we could do different things and teach somebody how to do something. Or the other way around, reality is, if they can teach me how to speak Spanish, I'd love it. So I just think that there's no relationships, unfortunately.
So I really appreciate, Jean, that you at the end there sort of caught the, and they could teach me something that I also don't know. And that's a piece of that breaking that pattern, right? You know, breaking the pattern of, you know, here's this church with, you know, we've got the stuff and the people and the answers, and we're going to go into this school and they're just full of need. And so that shift to we can actually give to and receive from each other, so that it's a two-way reciprocal kind of relationship. And you know, obviously, you know, kids actually are, because kids aren't fully socialized yet, kids typically are much better than adults are at calling that giver receiver relationship and saying, no, that's not what I want. You know, and they'll say it in terms of, you know, you don't care about me, right? You're just here to, you know, I just have to read this stupid thing and you don't really care about me. You know, kids get that. And it's, you know, with kids, stuff tends to be closer to the surface than adults, because adults learn to stuff things down until they get old, and then the stuff starts coming back out again. But so kids are actually typically very good about identifying, no, that's, you know, that's not a that's not this you just have everything for me kind of relationship, but it's more it's got to be a two-way street. But those you're also talking about you know, building these relationships where you know, maybe it's, you know, reading to them is not the thing that they need. You know, maybe some other thing is the thing that really would be beneficial, but, you know, how do we knit together those relationships to the extent that we'd be able to say, yeah, actually, I know what you need. You know, that the volunteer coordinator sounds like they kind of were sitting in the place of, you know, to think about that in terms of our relationship with San Ysidro, which I just want to use as a model. I don't want to talk about San Ysidro anymore. I want to talk about West Des Moines. But using that as a model, that volunteer coordinator sort of sits almost in like the pastoral team kind of role, or maybe the mission coworker, right? Like they're sort of our point of contact into the community, so that we can have all these other relationships. But they get to say, you know, and a good volunteer coordinator will say very clearly, oh, all right, here's what I need a volunteer to do. You're going to do this thing, and we're going to find out whether you did it, right? You're not, you know, a classroom volunteer, you know, isn't just going to do the one thing that they feel like they should do. But a good volunteer coordinator is going to make really clear, here's what is actually needed here. Here's what's actually helpful here. And I'm not going to ask for somebody to come empty the trash cans, because we already have somebody doing that, right? Or I'm not going to ask for somebody to come read to our kids, because what they really need is math, you know? And they're working with the teacher. Mary gets to do that. Oh, Bev, you are muted.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. I think the coordinator doing her job, his or their, we'll give them a pronoun, their. So doing their job inquires to the volunteer, what do they like to do? And if it is not the need of your organization, then she'll wait. You want to keep both sides happy, right?
Right. Yeah. So, and that is like rule number one of managing volunteers, is that you have to know the volunteer is there for a reason too. But mm-hmm. you know, to take good care of a volunteer, you may say, oh man, Gene, you know what these kids really need is math. Do you know anybody who's good at math? Right?
Yeah, it's
because it's going to be really frustrating for the volunteer if they can tell that what the kid really needs is something the volunteer is not in a position to work with. And maybe the kid also needs, you know, the extra layers. Kids need relationships, so do grownups, right? Grownups are just better at pretending. You know, so maybe the kid also just needs that relationship, and we can figure out their math problem some other way, but what they really need is somebody to just muddle through whatever they need muddling through with, you know? So it's a, this is human work, right? But yeah, you're right. The volunteer coordinator needs to know, but this is like against the, that benevolent lie about the colonial logic, right? Because the colonial logic says, I'm doing this, I, the European, am doing this for you, the colonized person, or I, the Presbyterian, am doing this for you, the kid who has to go to Phoenix Elementary, man. I said that just for you, Deb. You know, that I'm going to do this for this kid just out of the goodness of my heart. And like, for me to really fully inhabit that logic, I have to pretend to myself that I'm not there for my own reasons too.
Go ahead, Bev.
I was just going to ask, is Phoenix a special needs school?
It's not a school anymore.
Oh.
It used to be in the poorer part of West Des Moines. So when I went to buy a house, I had a realtor tell me that I wanted to buy the house on 10th, not 8th, because then my kids wouldn't go to Phoenix. And I was a teacher there at the time. It wasn't a good experience. So that's what Nathan was referring to.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Okay. That's fine, Deb. Good.
Not to belabor the volunteer aspect of it. When we first got involved with Head Start in terms of volunteering, the teachers were very good about wanting people to come in and be help, you know, sit with the kids at lunch, be with them, help us when we're, you know, help the kids get dressed to go out to recess, be with them. It was always be with the kids. Just that's what the teachers felt was needed. And that was the easiest thing for a volunteer to do. Just go fit in, you know, go into playtime, go just be there.
Be a mom or a grandma.
Yeah. 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 And we could, you know, if we really chose to go that direction, we could be very involved with Head Start. At least that was the way it was eight or 10 years ago. I don't know what the, you know, it depends upon the directress and it depends on a lot of things right now, but you know, there's ways to be involved that aren't colonial.
I think we're between a rock and a hard place right now until we get through COVID and
vaccines
and into vaccines and to where everyone has had their shots. And then, because it's going to be quite a large number of people that need to be vaccinated. So we can talk about this forever and ever and not be able to really implement anything. One of the things that I have noticed, and it just makes me crazy, is less of the European colonization or whatever you want to call it, it's a white person's attitude. And I mean, that's the best I can call it. For example, I know of a number of churches and several specific ones that will do, or prior to COVID, I don't know if they're doing it anymore because COVID has screwed up so many things, but they would do a Wednesday night meal and it was open to anybody in the community. And not only could they come and eat there, but they could come and if they needed to take food home, they had the styrofoam and you could take a meal home. So some people would come in and they would take, well, I'm here and my wife is here, but I have three children at home who couldn't come. Could I please have three extra meals? And then they would thank them and then they would go, they would eat the meal and go home. Okay, So the complaint I heard from the churchgoer, from the church person, was, you know, they drive a car better than mine. You know, they really aren't grateful. You know, we spend all this time and money doing this. It's an attitude thing. I don't know how do you get rid of the attitude that these people come in and they're not grateful. And I think that's one of the hardest things for the white European, white people to determine is like, okay, either do it out of the goodness of your heart or don't do it. Because it's so annoying to say, you know, it's kind of like we were talking about last week. It's like, if the person comes and needs it, then you should be able to give it. But if you're not going to give it with joy and be pleasant about it, then, and you're going to whine and carry on about how this person, you know, has a car, maybe they sleep in their car. Maybe you don't know that. So I'm open to anybody's suggestion on how you get over that attitude on the majority of us who wander around and say how other people don't deserve things.
I think you are hitting the nail on the head as where that colonial mindset lives inside of us. And lives inside of me, that sense that if I do something nice for someone, they should be happy and they should be lower on the ladder than me, right? And like, I will just decide where on the ladder they are by what they drive or whatever it may be. So I think you're hitting it on the head with the way that I think this really is relevant to how we go through the world. Go ahead, Russ.
I can't help but think there's an awful lot of this going on in Washington these days, too.
Now, that's like red meat in front of me, you know that. But I'm gonna actually pull us back from Washington and back into West Des Moines.
That's okay.
If you go anywhere with it, go to the Golden Dome, not the White Rotunda. If you want to step into that space, but where is that attitude alive? That Gene talked about the way that we. When I do something nice for you, I should decide how much nice you're entitled to, and you should be happy about that. How do we walk that back inside ourselves? How do we change our mental approach? Say that again, Bev.
I said, and others around. How do we deal not only with ourselves, but with others that act that way? You know, I think it's almost a feeding off of, it can be the whole thing.
Yeah. So
I brought it up.
Yeah. So I will grant as a legal topic, how do we manage our reaction to other people's colonial attitudes. I will say an out of bounds topic is how do we change other people's colonial attitudes?
Oh, I don't think that's going to happen.
Mm-mm. Well,
and so let's just,
yeah. I think we have to
our own
first. I would be very happy to know if there was some kind of, I want to know if there's some kind of response, because when I totally don't agree with it. I totally don't think that we need to be, if just for the grace of God, none of us are walking in those people's shoes.
Right.
It's just the way that it came out. I don't think that I've gotten over to, that sounds so egotistical. I don't mean it to be that way. That I don't look at it in that direction, but I don't know what kind of response to have to the people that I'm working with or somebody else that says, well, you know, they don't deserve it, or we don't. And I'm thinking, why do you do it then? But I don't know how to, I don't know how to respond. And I just find it so depressing.
So as a teacher, I used to have a lot of toys, extra gloves, stuffed animals in my classroom. And other teachers would sometimes say, don't they just get stolen or broken? And I would say, yeah, actually a lot of the Beanie Babies disappear. And I hope that the child that took it needed it more than my classroom did, and just kind of smile and move on. And after a while, I'd start to notice that the people around me, the teachers that I spent more time with, were responding the same way and making some of those things their same things that they did too. They brought in stuff that they knew the kids didn't have and wanted and let it be available. And I would say that clearly in my class, if you need to borrow it, go ahead. And when you're done with it, maybe you could bring it back. And some things did come back with some kids and some things I never saw again. But maybe if we keep modeling it, eventually it'll be deep in our own hearts and then other people will pick up on it. I don't know what else we do other than just keep modeling it over and over and over.
I don't know
if it'll work, but I hope it will.
It's that saying about walking in their shoes. You know, I kind of feel that we aren't familiar with that until we walk in their shoes, what they need. And you just...
And so, but see, that's it. From their perspective on some of the things I've read and people that have been speaking over the last times, even if you attempt to walk in their shoes, you really can't. You really need to look at them and say, okay, I have no way to relate to your experience. I would be really open to having you tell me what your experience is and what it is that maybe I could help with.
That's exactly. Oh, I'm sorry, Jean. I think I must have misphrased. I'm talking about when you have a person next to you saying, they drive a better car than I do. Why am I here? Why am I doing this? We're not. To that person is where I was, you know, and I've never had the opportunity, or, you know, walking in their, I wouldn't want to walk in their shoes. You know, I don't know. What's the right saying, Nathan?
I am.
Yeah, that's.
So I was about to raise my hand and vote for Jean's initial response, which was, well, then why are you here? I think that would be a fun response to have and would prompt a lot of really pleasant conversation.
That's the child in you coming out.
That's right. So, yeah.
Latent child.
Yeah. So how do we, you know, again, like, how do we manage our response to somebody else's response, right? I really appreciate, you know, and Deb, I know you, you just sort of inhabit this. This is, we see this in you, but the way that you shared with us just really briefly in there, the story that you tell yourself about why someone may not, you know, handle the thing that you loaned them in the way that you might have otherwise preferred that they handle it. You know, and to be able to say, well, maybe they needed it more, and that you created for yourself a practice of, here's how I'm going to present this. You know, if you need something, you can borrow it and maybe you'll bring it back. You know, kind of, we all know that this may not end well for that pair of scissors, but we're naming out loud the assumption that, yeah, that might happen. And so there's a piece of, you know, the ways that we talk to ourselves I think really they have a lot of power over how we then interact with other people. And so to just sort of reinforce that story of, you might borrow something, you might need it, I might never get it back, they must have needed it. And I imagine that, you know, I imagine that that sometimes took more work than it took at other times. That there probably were, there probably were kids that, yeah, I can very easily picture why they needed that. And other kids that you think, oh, they're going to borrow this and it's never going to come back. And
the other thing that changes that is if we're working with people by not going in and fixing things, but we're listening to them and developing as much of a relationship as we have the opportunity to. But I mentor in an after school program once a week, unable to do that this year. But last year, we have about 30 minutes. We have a Bible lesson and we have dinner, and it's a two and a half hour program. Gym time and craft time and 30 minutes of tutoring. And if they don't bring their homework with them, you kind of have to fill that time. And after watching the mentors all fill time with word searches and a game that had nothing that wonderful about it, one of the supervisors said, have you asked your kids what they want to do if they don't have homework? And when we did, my two little third graders said, could you read to us? Well, of course I could read. And that's like my most favorite thing to do. So we spent the rest of that year, and there was a big chunk of it left, reading with kids. And then other people picked up on that. And by the end of the year, everybody was reading for at least half of their tutoring time to their children. And the kids were bringing books from school, and we were bringing books from home, and the church had books, and all these different things happened. But it was because we listened to them instead of thinking that we know best, which we were trying to do, but we didn't know best. They just wanted to be read to, and to have an adult sitting with them reading to them for a little bit of time meant the world to them. So this year we're just writing letters, and then they have to write back to us, which I don't know if that's a plus or if the writing back is pretty cumbersome for some of them. But my mentor-y child from last year has already written me a letter saying, can you read to us again? And I'm hoping that I'll be able to get together with them this summer once vaccines are in arms, because they really, really like that over all the many things we did. And that's true in every story. If we have a relationship and we don't think we know how to fix it, I'd like to learn how to make tortillas. And that's something I would love to learn how to make, but I've never asked the two Hispanic children that I worked with all the last 2 years. And I'm sure their families would be willing. So those kinds of give or take things are what really make a difference for people. We had the family from Nigeria too. And I remember talking to Evelyn, and she said, what we've heard about Americans is they develop relationships, but it's only at a surface level. It's not a deep relationship like we have in Nigeria. And I felt offended. And yet I met them 4 or 5 years ago, and I've probably talked to them not at all in the last 12 months. But I spent a whole lot of time the first couple of years driving them around and getting their kids into college and helping them get apartments and houses and all the things that I did. And then when their basic needs were met, I let it slide. And so she's right. I did exactly what she said I'd do, and I swore I wouldn't. But we move too fast and our lives go too fast. And that's an issue with this kind of colonialism, demystifying it.
That is a really poignant example of the way that those relationships can, you know, go and then not go. And at the same time, yeah, as you describe the power of those relationships with the, you know, with those kids, that then you could say, all right, I don't know what you want to do. Why don't you tell me what you want to do? and what a gift that they landed on your favorite thing. So that is, yeah, that is some of the work of so the title was Decolonizing Mission. Really, we're talking about decolonizing our relationships with the world around us. So we're going to do one more week of conversation based on the World Mission Initiative. And we're going to look at a church that was one of the, you know, cornerstone churches of their neighborhood. As the neighborhood went through a great big series of transitions. So you can call it decline. You can call it, you could call it all kinds of things. If you're thinking in post-colonial language, it's the you know, that spot ceased to be important for the powers that be. What does the transformation of that neighborhood look like in the in relationship with this church that has been in the neighborhood? So you've got new people, you've got old people in terms of time in the neighborhood. And how do we navigate that? So this is going to be, again, sort of a church in relationship with their community. So I think it should be sort of a natural outgrowth of the conversation that we've had this evening. And again, very much at home in terms of this is our neighborhood. And, you know, we can define neighborhood in whatever way is meaningful for our conversation. But we will hear from Patrice Fowler Searcy next week. And there will be a link to that in your Covenant Corner tomorrow. So take a look, pre-watch if you are interested. And we will continue the conversation next week. Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.